Good morning and welcome to this September 23rd, 2015 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. We are on iTunes. We are on Barbara's website, penonfire.com. We are on Stitcher. We are on Facebook. We are on Twitter. There's no reason you shouldn't be listening to us, virtually 24 hours a day. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. We're doing what we do every Wednesday morning, which is talk with authors about not only their books, but their writing process, creativity, craft, all those things that separate those of us who want to write or who do write from those of us who actually publish. Rumor on the street has it that I am a fanatic for the short story form. So it is my pleasure to welcome Karen Joy Fowler. And in the second half, I'm talking to Bonnie Jo Campbell about her short story collection, Mothers Tell Your Daughters. Stay tuned for that. But first, Karen Joy Fowler is the author of 6 novels and 3 short story collections. The Jane Austen Book Club spent 13 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list and was a New York Times notable book. Karen's previous novel, Sister Noon, was a finalist for the 2001 Penn Faulkner Award for Fiction. Her debut novel, Sarah Canary, was a New York Times notable book, as was her second novel, The Sweetheart Season. In addition, Sarah Canary won the Commonwealth Medal for the Best First Novel by a Californian and was listed for the Irish Times International Fiction Prize, as well as the Bay Area Book Reviewers Prize. Karen's short story collection, Black Glass, won the World Fantasy Award in 1999, and her collection, What I Didn't See, won the World Fantasy Award in 2011. Karen joins us this morning from Santa Cruz, California. We're talking about Black Glass, which has just been re-released. Karen, hello.
Hello, Marie.
Hello. So tell us, I'm going to let you tell us a little bit about Black Glass, sort of take us into the collection. It came out like 15 years ago originally. So talk a little bit about what you were thinking about then and what was on your mind then when you wrote it and sort of, the scope of the collection a little bit.
It's been a little exercise in time travel to have it come out again. As a general rule, I don't look back. I figure, once a book is out and I can't change it anymore, there is no point in discovering all the things that I did wrong. And so it's best to always sort of keep my face firmly forward. So this has been an unusual activity for me to pick up stories that come from long ago and reread them and try to remember what I was thinking at the time. I was clearly very, very upset by the invasion of Panama, which now seems like distant history. I remember feeling that the first Bush presidency was a real low point in international relations. Mm. Little did I know what lay ahead.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now that the book has been out for 15 years and germinated, and like you wrote a really lovely preface to the book about the way your writing has changed and the way your thinking about writing has changed since the book was first released. But now that these stories, 15 stories, have sort of germinated, do you see them differently than you did? Do you think when you wrote them, has the book it sort of changed in your mind given the time and length that it's been out?
I think that I am simultaneously surprised by the things that clearly did obsess me but seem to no longer obsess me, and equally surprised by the obsessions that seem to be pretty steady in my writing. So, there are things that I have kind of moved on from. I'm less interested, for whatever reason, less concerned about relationships between men and women and more interested in the sort of family dynamic, particularly of siblings, brothers and sisters, is where my head is at now.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say it's kind of interesting where people are in their time of life, and you wonder if it's what's going on in the world around them or just sort of our natural evolution as, people through time, that in our 20s we're interested in, you know, 20-year-old stuff, finding spouses.
Absolutely.
And careers.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, and in sort of the twilight of life, we're more interested in family connections and looking back on, you know, what was important in our lives.
Well, siblings seem particularly interesting to me now because I think that your brothers and your sisters, should you have them, know you possibly better than anybody else in the world. That, you know, your parents are too complicit in whatever your flaws are and too eager to overlook them, too eager to see the best in you. And your siblings feel no such compunction, and they see you when you are not putting on a performance of any kind. So, and yet, you know, they are not, this is not a relationship that you chose. It is maybe not a relationship that is easy or works well, although it can be.
Yeah.
So all of that seems to be fascinating to me right now.
Right. Right. So you had said that it was very unusual for you to look back and to take stories out that you couldn't do anything with. So talk a little bit about why this collection and why now, why revisit it?
Well, the idea to reprint it came from my publisher, and I must say that I was terribly pleased, but also quite surprised that I think that it was done partly out of generosity and partly because they could see that I got quite a bit of attention for my last novel and that my next novel is nowhere near coming out. So mm-hmm. I think they wanted to remind people of a collection that didn't get much notice when it was first published, hoping that it would get more notice now, but also just sort of to keep my name live.
Yeah.
For the years that it takes me to write a novel.
And it is. You know, I was just talking to a random person on the street, and they said, oh, we just chose that book for our book club. And I said, you know, it was written, you know, in the 90s. And he said, yeah, I hadn't heard of it then. And so I was so pleased to see it now. So I think...
Well, that is nice to hear.
Yeah, your publisher's instincts were exactly right. So in the preface, you talk a little bit about having a happy childhood and how you had originally thought that that was maybe a negative for a writer, that, you know, writers depend on dark and dismal childhoods for material to write about. And actually, the way that you got your dark material was through reading and through the discovery of the lie your parents had told you that the world was really a nice place, and you know, reading Time magazine and books about the Holocaust to discover the, you know, maybe the world wasn't as
yeah,
great as your parents
the
had
true
told
horror
you. The true horror, right. Do you, I assume you just wrote the preface, so you continue to believe, do you think that your happy childhood was sort of a handicap in some way of, you know, not giving you as much material as you might have had as other writers who lived through harder stuff?
I like to say that. I don't think I actually believe it. But I think it did was to orient me slightly differently from writers who are drawing more on their own experiences and their own difficulties. I'm not sure that the distinction I'm making is actually a distinction that has a difference. But my impulse when I'm writing is to look outward. I'm not trying to understand the things in my own life so much as trying to imagine what it would be like to be someone else, to have had a different childhood, to have, you know, grown up in a different time, in a different place, and under very different circumstances. And the sort of energy that feeds me when I'm writing is that imaginary journey into things I don't know and I don't understand. And I know that other writers look very deeply into themselves in order to find their material and to find the story that they and only they have to tell. As I said, it feels like a big difference to me. When I talk about it, it feels like a big difference in the way I begin my process and the way I begin to think about things, but all writers really depend on their own autobiographies to enormous extents, and I am simultaneously looking outward and using a lot of my own material in order to make that bridge between me and the person I'm imagining I might have been.
And I don't think it requires you living through a ton of horror to imagine a ton of horror, you know. You had a wonderful phrase in the preface that then appeared in one of the short stories, which is talking about these bonsai children, these two children that were trapped in the basement of their home by their parents and sort of stunted. And I love the phrase bonsai children. And then when I came across it again in the collection itself, it was, you know, sort of a double pleasure. But certainly you don't have to live through those things to imagine, you know, the rich imagination of the writer's mind doesn't have to go through it to
have the empathy. No, you know, I assume that there are things beyond our imagining. And so if you haven't lived through them, you will fall short in certain ways. But I also think that the child development psychologist Piaget says by the time we're 6 years old, we've experienced every human emotion. And so, you know, we know what terror is, even if we've really had no occasion to be genuinely terrified, and so on and so on.
Right, right. You said that one thing that has changed in your work is that you're much more willing to appear on the page than you used to be, that you sort of insert yourself as the narrator in the stories, and the reader has more knowledge of your opinion as narrator than they used to back in the day. I thought that was an interesting observation. I wonder if that comes with writing experience or if it comes with age or, you know, and wisdom and self-confidence.
I'm sure self-confidence must be part of it. Often, and this is more true in my short stories than in my novels, although it was very true in my last novel, often I really do have something I want to communicate to the reader, something I want the reader to understand that in the way that I am thinking about it, you know, not necessarily to agree with me, but to understand what I am thinking and what I am trying to say. And, you know, sometimes it's easier just to come onto the page and tell them that.
Why don't you just tell me what you mean?
Exactly. This is what I want you to get out of my story.
Right, right. What a liberating thing. What a liberating concept that is. My guest this morning is Karen Joy Fowler. The collection is Black Glass. That's just been re-released. It was originally out in 1999. So let's get into sort of the nuts and bolts of short storytelling because you're so wonderful at it. The one thing that struck
Thank
me
you.
About the collection is even the ordering of the stories built on itself. And we have, you know, the opening story opens in a bar. The closing story closes in a bar. There's just this, you know, kind of wonderful arc of women, strong women throughout. So talk a little bit also about not just the individual stories, but having the stories make sense in a narrative thread just by the ordering of them in the collection.
Well, I think that's a very interesting question for a number of reasons. But first of all, I should say that my editor had a great deal to do with the ordering of the collection, and I had no clear through line or vision and depended very much on her. I'm sorry, I've got allergies, and
I'm sorry.
Every once in a while I'm going to have to cough.
No worries.
So we spent a lot of time on it. We spent a lot of time talking about it. We spent a lot of time going back and forth about it, looking for an order that would be tonally varied and varied in terms of length and varied in terms of emotional impacts. And the thing that strikes me as sort of odd about the whole enterprise is that when I pick up a collection of short stories, even though I know all of that work has gone in to determining the order, I never read them in the order that they appear in the book. Do you?
No, I don't. But then I go back in hindsight and say, that order made sense. But no, I don't. And the other wonderful thing about this is your draw towards science fiction and fantasy elements that you sort of use, aliens and extraterrestrials throughout a lot of these stories. Some stories are grounded completely in the real world, and some take on, you know, some interesting fantastical elements. And talk a little bit about your draw towards that, what you think the alternate universe can do for fiction that the real universe maybe can't.
I think the real universe is more science fictional with every passing moment. So realism strikes me as a mode whose time has sort of begun to pass. And I can say a little more about that later. But the first thing I'd like to say is that that I think all of these fantastical elements work particularly well in the short story. I think you know, you can use them to sort of maximum impact without having to drain the energy from them by explaining them over the way you would have to over a longer work. And I think that people who are not really familiar with science fiction are probably unaware of the fact that there is a very lively and fabulous world of science fiction short stories that the magazines publish a number of them every month, and a lot of them are in conversation with each other. There are a number of traditions in the field that you can sort of trace back, seeing who the influences on a particular kind of story are. So there's just, for me, there's a lot of energy and there's a lot of life in that particular small world that I have been privileged to be part of. To return again to the question about realism versus science fiction, I heard, I was listening to NPR driving somewhere. This is now several months ago, possibly a couple of years ago, but I heard three stories just sort of back to back that really crystallized for me why I think realism is just not up to the task anymore. And the first one was about a woman in India who had been found guilty of murdering her fiancé, and the only evidence they had was her brain scan. That when they asked her questions about the murder, the part of her brain that associates with memory lit up. And according to the radio report, that was it in terms of their evidence against her. But it was enough in the court to find her guilty. The second was about a place on the Internet where for a monthly fee, a machine will pray for you ceaselessly. And the third was about some work being done by a professor at UC Santa Barbara on the impact of a kind of parasite carried by the family cat that can infect humans. And his research is focused on the behavioral impacts, the idea that certain parts of your personality may be an expression of the fact that your cat has infected you with this parasite. And those three stories, just taken all together, made me think this is that we live in a science fiction novel now. Any sort of realism has to look more like science fiction and less like what we imagine realism to look like.
Right. And when you look at some of these science fiction short stories that were written, you know, Philip Dick or Ray Bradbury, we're not that far, you know, now that we've advanced another 15 or 20 years or 30 years from their short stories, you're right. I mean, their science fiction has become reality so quickly.
Yeah, it's amazing. My friend, the great writer Kim Stanley Robinson, says that we are all living in a science fiction novel. The only question is, which of the writers' novels is it?
Yeah.
Is it Bradbury? Is it Philip K. Dick? It's looking more and more like Philip K. Dick.
Yeah, it is. It is. Yeah, amazing. My guest this morning is Karen Joy Fowler. The collection is Black Glass that we're talking about. The hard part for me, well, there's so many hard parts for me about writing short stories, but one of them is finding the point of entry and the point of exit, because the world is very tight. As you were saying, you know, you don't have to describe a lot of the, you know, if you're doing a science fiction short story, you don't have to describe a lot of the rules of the world. You just assume that your readers are kind of going to go along with you. But finding that point of entry and especially endings, I think, are so very tricky in short stories, and creating that world. Is there anything you can say about that, about, you know, kind of knowing when to get in and when to get out of a short story? I know it's different for each one, but is it intuition, or do you?
It is really tricky stuff, I think. I first of all, you know, as you've all but said, I think a short story, as opposed to a novel, really lives or dies on its ending. That the ending just has a power that carries over the whole story in a way that is not true in the longer forms. So it is really important to get that right, to get it right enough.
Right enough.
I usually want to, as my writing process, I'm usually flailing about for quite some time when I start. I have something so vague in my head often that I don't really know what story I'm telling. Another writer has said to me that her short stories always rise out of the ashes of the story she thought she was going to write, and that has been true for me as well. So in terms of beginnings, it takes me a long time to find it, and when I do find it, it's always very provisional. I sort of think, okay, I can go forward from this point, so I will. It doesn't necessarily mean that once I get to the ending, I will still think that's the right place to start. So mostly my process, and I'm sorry I can't really be helpful, it's all very airy, but my process is to sort of find a beginning I like, write a story towards an ending, or, get to an ending that I feel is right, and then begin the work of actually structuring the story. Now that I have a sort of sense of where it ends, I have a much better sense of where it's going to begin and where the climax is going to be and what I want the reader to be surprised by at what point. So I have to get to the ending before I can kind of begin to think about the story.
I really am gripping onto the phrase of the story rising out of the ashes of what you thought it was going to be, and the idea that you have to get to the end to even know what the story is trying to be. I wonder if who you, what the story becomes over the course of doing that is so very different than what you thought you were writing about originally. I wonder if we could, you know, just take one of these stories as an example. Maybe the last story is about a pregnant woman who's been left by her married lover, and she's in a bar having a conversation with a woman. I'm not going to give it away, but just as a story, as an example, do you remember what you thought that story was going to be about versus what it became about?
A little bit. I think it came from some leftover research that I had done for my very first novel. So I did a lot of research. I've written about San Francisco and about the sort of Pacific Northwest in two novels. And there were just so many fascinating stories that were actually historical in nature that I couldn't cram it all in. And so when I started that story, I thought I would be writing a historical story, and I thought it would be about a woman named Laura D. Fair, who was the first woman sentenced to hang in California. And so that's where I began, and that was my impulse, and those of you who've read the story can see that it turned out to be something quite different.
Yeah, I love that. It was funny because I was reading other reviewers' reviews of some of these stories, and they said in this story was about, you know, duplicity was about a woman who was really bored with her average lover and sought comfort elsewhere. I'm like, is that what that story was about? Because that's not what I thought it was about. And I thought, what a great commentary on your collection that we can all come to it, enjoy it, and say, you know, and have arguments about what, you know, what the stories were really about. I thought was really wonderful.
It's one of the great pleasures of being a writer is having other people tell you what you've written.
Exactly. That's funny. We're drawing down on our time, but I wonder if there were things we should have been talking about that we weren't talking about when we were so rudely interrupted by the by the disclaimer woman. If there's advice that you can give, I don't know, notes of endings that we should end on.
Let me think. Gosh, I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank.
I put you on the spot.
I think we've covered everything that It's on my mind this morning.
I love that even though it's a distant promise that there's another novel in the works. And I had read that this one's about San Francisco. Is that right?
No.
No. No, that is wrong.
That was wrong, yes.
Okay.
Although I do, I did in my head when I wrote Sister Noon, which is my first San Francisco novel, I did think it would be a trilogy. So
Okay. Someday
there may be two more. It depends on how long I live.
I love it. I love it. Well, keep going forever and ever. If we live in this scientific, alternate universe of Philip Dick novels, I think, maybe we'll all
immortality
go on.
Can only be just around the corner.
Exactly. We'll all go on forever, and there'll never be an end to all of this writing stuff. It'll be great. Karen Joy Fowler, thanks so much for taking the time this morning. This was fun.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Bonnie Jo Campbell will be joining me for the second half of the show. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events. You can find us on Facebook. We're on Writers on Writing, KUCI FM. We are on Twitter. We are on Stitcher. I am your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Bonnie Jo Campbell teaches in the Low Residency MFA program at Pacific University. She's the author of Once Upon a River and American Salvage, finalist for the National Book Award and National Book Critics Circle Award. She was on the show with me for that book back in 2010. A podcast of that interview you can find up on our website. And I think you can find it on hers as well. She's back now with another collection, Mothers Tell Your Daughters. It's published by Norton, and it's what we're talking about this morning. Bonnie Jo, welcome back.
Oh, well, thank you so much for inviting me.
I am as I mentioned in the first half hour, I'm a freak for the short story form. So every time I see a collection, especially a collection by somebody that I've known and loved, I just get giddy. So this is...
Well, it was such a nice surprise that, I actually sold two books to Norton, and they wanted to go with the short stories first, and I was really thrilled about that. We're going to get our due for these short stories.
Damn it, right? you always hear that it's the, sort of ugly stepchild to the novel, and I just feel like maybe that's not true anymore. There's so many collections out, and they're winning prizes, and they're winning Pulitzers, and, I don't know. Publishers always say they don't sell, but I'm starting to not believe it because I see them all over the place, thank goodness.
Yeah, I think that George Saunders book did okay, didn't it?
I feel like he's fine. And the Adam Johnson just came out with that great collection. There's so many. So I'm hoping we're enjoying a renaissance. That's my hope. So I just saw some interview you did a while back with Jamie Gordon and Jessamine Ward for the National Book Award, and you said, if you don't like any of the questions that I'm asking, just feel free to answer something else. So that goes here too. If you don't want to talk about what I want to talk about, that's fine. I just want to hear what you have to say. So you can go, cat, go. You can say anything you want.
Yeah, that was in pretty high powered company there with those two National Book Award winners. So
we just want to hear.
I was willing to listen to anything they had to say. So thank you for extending that to me.
That's
too.
How I feel about you. I want to hear everything you have to say. So, I actually became reacquainted with you and this collection through the title story, Mothers Tell Your Daughters, because it was published by One Story, which is near and dear to me because I spent my summer with them this summer. And so maybe we could use that story as our point of entry for the collection to talk about maybe that story in particular and sort of how it became the title for the collection and kind of the collection as a whole. What's on your mind when you're writing these stories? Just kind of take us into the book.
Yeah. Well, I didn't set out to write a book of stories that would have this title, but I looked at the stories I had and started seeing where my, when I'm writing stories, I'm just following my obsessions and I'm following my even anxieties and worries about life. Those are the things that cause me to write stories. And so stepping back and taking a look at them to see what, in fact, I have been doing. Very interesting. And we, my editor at Jill Bielowski at WW Norton and my agent, Bill Clegg, we were trying to puzzle out exactly what was the essence of this collection. And it's funny to think about it from the point of view, you know, after the book has been published, it seems obvious what it's about. Mm-hmm. But, you know, beforehand, struggling to come up with an understanding of what a certain body of work does is a whole different project. And the title story, Mothers Tell Your Daughters, was the last story I finished for the collection, because I realized what the collection was about, and I realized what it needed. And so what it needed was the title story. And I was very interested in, I've always been interested in the tough mother figure. The mother figure that maybe it's of a bygone era, but the mother figure who had to struggle for survival even while raising kids. And well, I say it's a bygone era, but a lot of my relatives are doing the same thing. But struggling so much that maybe a certain kind of softness and gentleness is completely dispensed with.
Uh-huh.
And so I was interested in this mother figure who had really, in our eyes, betrayed her daughter, but now was unable to apologize for it, but then also didn't find herself wanting to apologize for it.
Right. Do you have daughters? Because all of these stories struck home because I have a teenage daughter, and it's so terrifying to be raising a teenage.
Bless you. I have a lot of nieces. I have no children. I always say I'll die miserable and alone unless I'm really nice to my students. But I do have a lot of nieces, and I have been finding so many of the stories in this collection integrate some kind of sexual violation.
Yeah.
And it makes them kind of tough to read for some readers. But I find that when I look at my beautiful nieces and great nieces, I'm 53 now, so I have a good selection of them, I just find myself filled with worry and anxiety for them. I love them so much that I almost can't look in their faces without crying.
Yeah.
And, you know, with this knowledge of that there is tough stuff to go through for these young women.
Well, you just got it so right. I mean, the emotional notes that you hit again and again, you're right. It's sometimes hard to read, but it's so spot on.
Thank you.
I guess just living through the world as a woman, you know, you absorb a lot of that as well. But you got it so right. One thing I want to talk about with relation to this story that then maybe can take us into the discussion of titles in general. I find titles of short stories really very tricky because they need to resonate on a couple of levels. And it's so unfair for short story writers because, you know, you only have to title a novel once and you have to title short stories 15 times.
You know? Yes, there's 16 stories and they all had to have the right title.
Right.
Well, I will confess that many of these stories were published in literary magazines under different titles.
Okay.
In other words, I had, even though I thought I had come up with the right title, when I saw the work later and when I saw the work in its entirety, I had not come up with the right title.
And I thought, you know, when I read Mothers Tell Your Daughters, I was like, well, okay, what would I, you know, I was trying to, cover up the answer key and come up with my... come up with my own and then check my work. And I was like, you know, as a rookie, I probably would have said like women's studies comes up a couple of times in that short story. And I thought, oh, that could be interesting. Or crossroads comes up at the end. And then I don't even think Mothers Tell Your Daughters is in the, it isn't a phrase
well, I'll
in
tell
there.
You, honestly,
and it's so perfect.
I came up with the title before I came up with the story.
Oh, it's so perfect. And I thought I'd live 1,000 years and never come up with that. So,
well, it's more that it's somehow the essence of the book was a cautionary message, and you know we all love that the old folk song, "City of New Orleans," and we've often heard it with "Mothers Tell Your Children," but originally it was and Dolly Parton does a version where she brings back "Mothers Tell Your Daughters."
Right.
And so I was thinking of that kind of cautionary, that cautionary feeling of what mothers can do, what mothers can do for their daughters in all kinds of ways.
Yes, right, right. There's a couple of things that you do so well, so uniquely that I've encountered that I want to share with our listeners tips and tricks on craft. One is you have a wonderful way of describing your characters without physical descriptions, that we know who these people are by the way they speak, by the way they think, by their gestures are so incredibly unique. I can't remember a lot of physical descriptions of some of these characters, and yet I know exactly who they are. And I thought that was a really interesting way to get at character absent physical descriptions of them, but doing it all through their voice, all through the way they speak, all through their mannerisms. And is that conscious, or how do you do
that? I always shy away. Though I love Charles Dickens, where we can spend a whole page describing what the urchin is wearing, I just feel like that's not part of my project. I want to rely on the reader to paint the picture, to paint the physical picture. I want to create the emotional tapestry or the emotional picture, and hope that make the reader do the work of filling in the physicality. Ages ago, somebody once told me that to describe a character, you really just need three things. And I've sort of taken that to heart. Just one gesture, one description of a way of walking, one a color of an eye or something. And I found for me that's enough. Mm. And I know that's different for different readers and for different writers. It really varies. And I do love to luxuriate in rich description, but for myself, it feels better to leave that to the reader.
And you almost can tell a lot about a character just by the objects around them. You know, describing their house almost describes them. You know, describing their bed almost describes them.
And I really rely on landscape. I'm known as a Michigan writer, and I'm known to really indulge Michigan landscapes in my stories. And I think I get more about the characters by turning often to natural landscapes where people are outside, or into the landscape of a home. I find that I like to rely on familiar landscapes, because then I already know what's there, and it's amazing how whatever you need for your character, it's there.
Yes,
it's one of the magic. Someday I'm going to write a list of the 10 magical things about writing, and that's going to be one of them. That whatever you need for a character, somehow, if you've put the character in the right place, you'll be able to pluck out that detail.
Could you write that tomorrow? Because that would be really helpful.
I know. We need it, because we need magic. Yeah. Because writing is too hard.
It's too hard. If you have the rules, could you share it with us? But that's a good one.
Writing is too difficult. And it, without a little bit of magic, or without a little bit of coincidence, we wouldn't make it.
Yes. Right. Right. The other great thing about some of these is your juxtaposition of innocence against sinister. So you have one story where it's about a rape, but it's taking place while we're inside this little child's playhouse. You know, we're building a little plastic playhouse for this little girl, but the conversation is all about rape. And I thought, what another great device for writers is to take two very disparate things and put the little innocent 3-year-old girl next to, you know, what this other woman is going through, that just amps up the power.
Yeah, and these nieces again, you know, all these fictional and real nieces that we just look at and worry. But, you know, I'm interested in the American obsession with innocence. Americans more than Europeans, I think, are really attracted to the idea of purity and innocence, and I do like to mess with that and sort of undermine that So that was kind of what I was up to there. I'm not sure that the innocence in the form that we want it to exist doesn't really exist. You know, if we think, you know, probably even little children have, you know, we know they have horrible fears, you know, but they also have maybe even violent or fearful thoughts that are all their own. So I'm kind of interested in playing around with our idea of innocence.
I love that. I love that. My guest this morning is Bonnie Jo Campbell. The book is Mothers Tell Your Daughters. Collection is out this month. I've heard that it takes you sometimes years to write a short story. In the best case scenario, it takes you months. And Karen Joy Fowler was on in the first half, and we were talking about finding the story, your process of finding the story. And I had read that you had said at some point that the story often turns out to be something totally different, or you fall in love with a character totally different than what you originally went into it thinking. Can you talk a little bit about the process of ferreting out what the story is and how it sometimes changes on you? A little shapeshifter.
I know. Writing is so hard. We can keep saying that. What inspires me to get started is usually an interesting character in a really tough situation. And then from there, I puzzle about what I have. And often this comes from real life. And like I said, I write from what I'm anxious about or worried about. So I'll see some situation in real life. For example, that trouble with that the real life girl who didn't know she was molested until she saw the thing on somebody's camera phone, the evidence of it. And something like that just worries anyone who's, you know, a friend of young women. And so I was interested in a character like this who would be in a situation like that. But then I had to slowly develop the situation to reflect the character, and then I have to change the character to reflect the situation. So even though I might start out from some real-life place, usually that process of moving forward by revising the character and then revising the situation, and if you could see me, I'm moving my hand like forward along a timeline toward the ending of the story, and the ending meaning the place where I'm actually finished. You know, there could be a draft with a tentative ending early on, but for me, the first story that I end up writing is usually not good enough. It usually needs more intensity and more heat. I like to talk to my students about heating things up. So if we had a story of two people who didn't know each other having some relationship, well, let's say then if they're mother and daughter, we've got a lot more heat.
Yes.
In the situation.
Yes.
So sometimes it means I combine characters in the story. Sometimes I can intensify their relationships by say, making them related or putting them in, giving them a past together. And then the situation needs to really be as intense as it can based on who these characters are. So I don't want to ever be melodramatic, so I need to make sure that my characters have earned the place I'm putting them in.
Yeah.
So it makes me exhausted just talking about it.
No, I love it. I love it. This is pure gold stuff. The other thing that I don't know if it's a conscious device or I keep using the word device and it sounds like you're trying to trick somebody, which is not the case, but for lack of a better word, you take things away from characters. So in the story we've sort of been talking around here, you take away her memory, or in the title story you take away her voice. She can't physically speak, and so she's and yet she has so much to say. And I was wondering if that is something you're conscious of depriving a character of something to amplify the rest of them. You know, if we lose one of our senses, the rest of them get amped up, and that feels like something that your characters are going through, that they've lost something, and so they're punchier in other places.
That's interesting. Yeah, I haven't thought about it in those terms, but now I have been sort of, I often have characters who are in poverty, And I was trying to recently puzzle out, ask myself, why do I keep doing that? And I guess because that also, you know, to take away the, say, the guarantee of survival, so that it puts people in a position where they're a little more desperate, a little more urgent, I guess. And I really like what you just said, that the idea that the woman who has used her voice more or less to bully people or to make her life. She used her voice to make things okay in her life.
Mm-hmm.
She was such a good talker that she could talk other people into what she was presenting. And now without that, she has to find a way, just talking to herself in her head, she has to find a way to make her life okay. I guess that it is, that seems smart what you're saying I do. But to take away maybe some of our tools, some of the tools that a character usually would use, then a character has to be resourceful in a new way. And my characters, if anything, they're called upon by the trouble I put them in to be resourceful and to call upon all the skills that they have and all the ways of seeing the world that they have.
Boy, isn't that true? That is absolutely right. Yeah, if our listeners want a case study on voice, this book is it. I mean, finding the voice is so incredibly singular and strong. That's been true throughout all of your work. But there's no mistaking you. I could pick up a paragraph blindly and.
Oh, really? Oh, thank you for saying that.
Oh, I think so. Yeah, I think so. And you so effectively use second person. I'm going to just drop that in there because we don't have a ton of time to talk about it. But for people who are scared of second person, I've heard this over and over that, you know, it works better in shorter fiction than longer, obviously. But brilliant use of second person as well.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. I do enjoy those because those second person stories can have an energy. Sometimes you may use second person just as a tool to get yourself going in the story and then turn it into a first-person story. But I advise my students I give them an assignment sometime to take a story of their own and turn it into a second-person story and read it aloud, and they have fun with that.
I like that. That's a good trick. When do you know when to let a story go? If it's just not working and it's time to, you know, part ways with it, does that happen to you? Maybe that doesn't happen to you.
Isn't that funny? I never give up on a story ever.
Really? Wow.
I just don't. I think, you know, I've also been married for over 28 years. I don't give up on anything, I guess. Or my house, which is a horrible hovel, but I've lived here for 30 years. So, but I just believe these stories, if once I've been energized to make meaning out of a collection of characters and situations, I'm determined to make the most possible meaning out of it. It might take me 30 years, and probably I will die with some unfinished stories, but I do tend to stick with the stories as long as they need to be stuck with. The temptation, however, is to try to get them published before they're ready.
Well,
I have had a few stories published where, looking back, I realize this wasn't really ready, and that's why it's so wonderful to be putting this collection together, because I did take a lot of stories that I had published earlier that I really maybe had missed something in, and I really got a chance to finish them.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, that was going to be my follow-up question, is when do you know when to let a story go and throw it in the trash, and when do you know when to let it go and publish it? Because I think you can work a story. I've proven you can work a story to death, perhaps.
I know, and that's why, you know, some people talk about writer's block, and I don't ever have writer's block per se, but I have writer's block about a given story.
Uh-huh.
I do think we have to put stories aside, and even if you're like me and don't want to throw them away, you need, if your energy and enthusiasm is not with the story you're working on, you really need to put it aside. And if it doesn't come back, then just leave it in the drawer. Because these stories deserve our best.
Right.
Our best self and our best writer. And if something's not interesting us anymore, then maybe let it go and let it be the object that stood for us at a certain point in time and doesn't anymore.
I like that. You had also mentioned, and I thought this was important to mention to our listeners who are trying to publish out there, that there used to be a stigma on publishing in online journals, and you think that stigma is no more, that you reach a wider audience through online publications, and that the print publications often are still wonderful, so many great print publications, but not to be afraid of the online journals.
No, really, I really encourage people to find their favorite online journals and publish there. It gives us a place to show our work that's free. I mean, we'd love everyone we know to read what was written in the print version of the Kenyon Review, but we know that they don't have access to it, and it's a big commitment to go order a copy of the Kenyon Review, but the Kenyon Review has a wonderful online version, and you can send your friends a link to it. And there's a lot of fun journals online, and I think it's often more likely you'll find one that's your style online.
Yes, and it lives there forever. Whereas print journals are hard to find.
Even the magazines that have gone under, I think, you know, rest in peace, Pank magazine.
Yeah.
Just did its last issue, but they're going to keep the archives on there. And so, and here I'm already thinking of the caveat that tells me you really do want to make sure that story is finished.
Yes, right. It's out there forever, right?
Because it's out there forever. So in some way, the online publishing is even a little more, it's a little more important to get it right.
Yes. You will be immortalized on...
Yes.
This is our big jump towards immortality, publishing online.
Yes, and those Facebook pages that will stay on there even after we're gone.
Correct. I feel another short story about one of your poor nieces coming out of that whole
social
media debacle. And you had also mentioned, I wanted to tell I don't bring this stuff up often enough, of the great resources, but Duotrope, I heard you just mention in an interview, which is... exactly right. People should be going on to Duotrope for all these, you know, great publications that people may not otherwise know about. Are there other sources that you use?
Well, right now, I haven't been right now. I've sort of been relying on my old favorites for this collection.
Yeah.
I've been relying on my favorite magazines, Southern Review, Tusculum Review is a great one, Kenyon Review Online, which I really do love their online version. And so because I didn't have a lot of stories to send out, I'm not quite as up on my literary magazines as I should be right now, but there are even more sources than ever. Duotrope is a wonderful one, and some of my students have been telling me about other websites where the thing with Duotrope is I think now you do have to pay.
Oh, gotcha.
You do have to pay to belong, and it often is worth it. It's not a lot. I think it might be $10 or $12 a year, but there are other ones that are free, and so just look for lists, and I love those lists of everybody's favorite online magazines.
Yes, right.
You know, I really enjoy those, and especially if they'll give a little bit of reason why they like them.
And you can look in the back of these collections and see where, oftentimes it'll say where the stories have been published in the past, and you know, that's always
so
a good list.
Oh, that is so smart. Yeah, I always tell people there's actually no mystery about how to get published.
Yeah.
All you have to do is find where works like yours are getting published.
Right.
Okay,
it's just
but
time.
That means you have to know what
to
your works
it. Yeah.
are like.
right. First, you have to produce the work.
all that searching of your soul and your works to figure out who am I writing like? Is my quality similar to the stories in this magazine? And is the is maybe the bent or the sensibility similar to the stories that are in this magazine? And if the answer to those questions is yes, then that's a good place to send them.
Then you're good. Then you're good. Bonnie Jo Campbell, this was such a pleasure. I love talking to you. I could do this for hours, but we have to go.
Oh, we will sometime.
Wouldn't that be great? Thank you
so much.
We'll
have some coffee or maybe some wine.
Yes, there we go. I like it already. Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Okay, great. Well, it was sure a pleasure to spend time with you.
Me too. That was Bonnie Jo Campbell. The book is Mothers Tell Your Daughters. That's all the time we have for today. Stay tuned. Sister Rue is coming up with some reggae, and we will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. Until then, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.